Hello, and welcome to the 10th episode of 80 Game Club, the monthly video game club podcast where we choose a game from the past to play and talk about in depth. I am your host, Andrew, and joining me today is my best friend and co-host whose life support system is actually a high-speed combat mech, David.
Yes, although I do have a bumper sticker on it that says, my other high-speed mech is a joke that I hadn't thought of before we started this episode.
Better luck next time.
At someday I'll have one. I really will.
It feels like it's been a really long month between episodes. I don't know why. But at the top of the show, I would like to mention that 80 Game Club has a Facebook page. You can find it at facebook.com/80gameclub. There you can keep up to date with us throughout the month and participate in the conversation by leaving comments. And also letting you know that after this show, we plan to talk about some of our Kickstarter woes or maybe even successes, if you'd like to stick around for that, of games we've, like, funded and played and all that fun jazz. Anything you want to talk about before we get into our game of the month, David?
I guess the one thing that's been on my mind is I've been looking forward to going back to Nier Automata, which I started playing a while ago, but I've just been distracted with other games, including this month's game, Zone of the Enders 2. So a friend of the show, Lorenzo, has been talking a lot about how much he loved it.
Yes, he has.
I thought that was worth mentioning, that it was really fun from what I played, but I've barely gotten into it. So I'll probably have more opinions on that later.
I've been juggling a bunch of games recently. And I might actually finish Pokemon soon.
Well, wow.
That's been going on for a while. But without further ado, let's talk about Zone of the Enders 2, the second runner, I guess is how it should really be referred to. Originally released on the PS2 in 2003, and we also included the first Zone of the Enders as a bonus game, since they're pretty well tied together, mm-hmm. and they're both rather short. So, yeah, that's been fun. The familiarity for this game, my first console was actually a PS2. Like, I did not get into gaming early, and some of my initial games for that PlayStation 2 were Fantavision, because it came with the system, Kingdom Hearts, because Disney and Square Enix, like, I didn't even know how much I'd like Square Enix at the time, but Disney, I was there. Dot Hack Infection, and then Zone of the Enders 2 was actually one of my very first console games that I ever played. Not playing Zone of the Enders until a year or two later. So it was one of those games that I have very early in my history of gaming. Before I even was a serious gamer, before I even understood who people like Kojima were. And so, yeah, that pretty much covers my familiarity with this game and series, I'd say. How about you, David?
Mm-hmm. Funny side note, I actually, the first PS2 game I owned was Dot Hack Infection, which I bought before I had a PS2. Because there
really?
Was some, I don't remember what it was. It was probably, I don't think it was something super interesting. It was just like a rebate or something, but there is a bonus for pre-ordering the game, and I thought, this looks really cool, and I'm gonna want to play it, so I'll buy it now and get this pre-order bonus, and then, you know, in a couple months when I've saved up more money, I'll buy a PS2.
And, I mean, the Dot Hack series came with the anime, I can't even remember what it was called, like Luminity? Ah, why don't I remember that name? But it came with an anime DVD, so you were at least able to enjoy that.
Yeah, yeah. Funny
That's
story,
cool.
I never actually finished Dot Hack Infection or played the rest of the series either.
I, on the other hand, loved that series and easily sunk over 100 hours into that. It was, one of my early addictions.
After a certain point, it was like, if you weren't already into it, there were a million games and anime to watch, so it was hard to get into again.
That was a really good period for anime in general.
Yeah.
And I mean, the anime doesn't stop. Zone of the Enders 2, anime cutscenes. Like, really fun to see. But
So back to the topic. My familiarity with the Zone of the Enders series was before I played the first game. It was that game that came free with the Metal Gear Solid 2 demo, which I think was a lot of how a lot of people knew it. But it
gained enough of a following. Oh, sorry.
I think it gained enough of a following from people buying it for that reason and then playing it and enjoying it that obviously it got a sequel.
I did some research into this topic, and there's a couple of things. Like, personal feelings, I think they made this Zone of the Enders first game as sort of a, hey, we need to learn the PlayStation 2 and what kind of engines we can make on it. So that's the kind of feeling I get from the game itself, is more of a, like, just developers having fun seeing what they can do with the new hardware, which then they just decided to release anyways. But what I found interesting is that while Kojima sort of had the helm for the first game, he never wanted to make a second game. It was actually one of the artists or something behind the first game who was, he really liked Jehuti, and he came up with new story ideas that Kojima enjoyed enough that he decided to give that guy the chance to make Zone of the Enders 2. And all Kojima was really involved with was the producer role.
Oh, wow.
So even though the first game really sets it up for a sequel, they were never truly planning on one until much later. Well, not that long later, but a little bit later.
I'll be honest, I kind of got the feeling that they had, with the way that the story of Second Runner lines up, I kind of got the feeling that they had no idea what they were going to do at the end of the first one, so... I haven't heard that, but that makes sense.
We'll get into the beginning of the second game, but...
Yeah, so of course, we're talking about the second one, but we also played the first game. Before replaying it, I just remembered that Zone of the Enders was very short, but really stylish. And one thing that always stuck out at me was the rhythm of the sword combat was just really cool. I don't know why that stuck out in my head specifically replaying it now, but it was pretty cool, and it just felt cool to get into these sort of the clashes where you'd be attacking the enemy again and again until you broke through.
Yeah, and either having to break their shield or you're just like each bouncing off of each other. What I remember of the series was how the style of it, and that it was some pretty solid gameplay, especially the first one, for just being, like you said, a side game selling a demo.
Yeah.
It has a pretty cool anime storyline set style to it, and the combat was just fun. I remembered that even all these years later that I really enjoyed playing these games. Which is part of the reason why I suggested it for this podcast. I have these fond memories of this series that I haven't played in over 10 years. I bought the HD remake a couple years ago when that was relevant, but kept getting sidetracked, and it's been pretty high on my I want to replay this list, and I wanted to experience that again as part of this podcast. So,
And I always really wanted to finish the series, since the first Zone of the Enders ends on not quite a cliffhanger, but an unfinished story. And I hadn't even realized that there was an HD collection until you brought it up for the podcast. So I was really glad to finally... Well, to replay and then to finally finish the series.
Yep. And, yeah, with that, let's put a spoiler warning and start delving into the first Zone of the Enders. And so, I'm reading off of IMDb here. The plot of Zone of the Enders, a space colony named Antilia, revolving around Jupiter in the late 22nd century, is attacked by a terrorist force called Barum. They use orbital frames or big robots with many weapons that mostly are human-like in structure in their attack. their mission, capture the colony, and therefore taking control of two amazing new orbital frames being kept there. After his friends are killed by Bahram, we see Leo running along a hallway, and somehow he stumbles upon one of the new frames called Jehuti. Leo's only purpose is to get out, but personal feelings and a few other things get in his way. Things like a girl who stupidly wants to check out a church for survivors instead of escaping, a microwave wall, a virus, inept adults, and a really persistent orbital frame runner named Viola, who takes Leo's survival as a personal affront. Some of that may have been me adding, but anyways.
Now, I just want to point out, since you mentioned this girl who stupidly wants to check a church for survivors instead of escaping, that may seem harsh, but Jehuti has a scanner that could have immediately told her if any people were in the church, but she still had to run and check.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really stupid.
partly on Leo for not going, hey, Ada, scan the church for survivors, but still.
I mean, that was like in the first hour of even getting into Jehuti, right?
True.
Like, give him some break on not really understanding. Like, I just got an Alexa. I don't really know everything she can do for me yet. It'll take some time.
Alexa, scan the church for survivors.
She'll probably say you need to download an app for that, or so yeah, getting into Zone of the Enders, there's quite a bit that I enjoyed about this game, but replaying it one of the scenes I remember and I still absolutely love is actually at the end of the game, when you defeat Viola. And Viola is now falling into Jupiter's atmosphere, but slowly. Like, it's not an instant, oh, she's gone and dead. She's slowly falling into that gravity well. And during this time, you have the codec conversation with her, and she has a monologue, and you actually get to learn who she was and why she put you through this hell. And I just found it as a really awesome way to decompress after such an intense fight and then actually care about her as a character instead of just a generic bad guy who was harassing you this entire game. And then bam, Anubis shows up and it is epic. And Ada is just like, you are not meant to fight Anubis yet. I love that scene, how the pacing of it goes, and just the surprise, cause you don't, I at least can't think of many shows or stories that really do this, character development in this kind of way, and I still really enjoy this, and while a lot of this game may not have aged very well, I think that particular scene is, stands the test of time. But how about you, David?
I thought the controls were a little clunky, and like you said, it kind of felt like the team was figuring out what they could do with the PlayStation 2 console, so it's not quite so smooth. It's a little different than what you might have in a 3D movement nowadays.
And like the game advertises as being like fast paced or high speed combat, but when you're actually playing this first game, it actually feels really slow, especially compared to where the second runner goes with its combat.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, there were a lot of points where it's like you could rush in and attack, and you would be surrounded and get beat up. So you kind of have to, take a step back and pick out enemies as they approach. So it makes it more interesting, but it's also not quite as fast-paced as was advertised. And a lot of the combat, there were only a couple of kinds of enemies, and the combat outside of the bosses felt pretty much the same after a few missions. I really liked the character development of Leo and Ada, and the sort of, standard sci-fi cliche of, Ada is a cold...
Hal.
unfeeling AI, but through interacting with Leo, she learns to, you know, value him and human life and her own existence a little more. I was not as attached to Viola and the way that she sort of dumped all of her backstory at once when you try to kill her, but that was overall a really good end to the game, like you said.
Ada, at the first, she's all about, hey, logically and, like, probability-wise, we should be doing this. Why do you keep going out of your way to, like, save these humans who don't matter?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, it would be far more efficient to just kill everyone.
Right.
And then, or especially, like, your enemies. Every boss fight, she's like, hey, you should kill this person before they escape. And then Leo's like, no, I don't want to. And then they escape.
And then you get that kick at the end where you're like, wow, I'm really glad that Ada, you know, learned that, you know, learned to value life. And then she goes, oh, my mission. Yeah, I'm just going to go blow myself up. That was the plan.
To destroy Almon, she has to get into the center of it and self-destruct. That's her entire mission.
Mm-hmm.
Genius. Like, come on, Space Force people. that's what they're called, right? Now I don't remember.
Space Force, yeah.
Yeah. Pretty generic name. Bahram is unique. Then the good guys are just called the Space Force.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to mention about the first game before we jump into Zone of the Enders, the second runner?
Nope, that covers it.
Cool. So, I'll give the same sort of plot summary for the second runner. Dingo Egret is an ice harvester on the Jovian? I don't really know that. I know it means related to Jupiter, but the Jovian moon of Callisto, who discovered a lone orbital frame, Jehuti. As he is investigating, incoming Bahram enemies start attacking Callisto, and Dingo has no choice but to enter and pilot Jehuti. Dingo fights the enemies, and upon boarding the Bahram ship, Dingo encounters Anubis, an orbital frame that is a stronger version of Jehuti. Dingo's orbital frame, Jehuti, is defeated in battle against Anubis, and after that, Noman, the runner of Anubis, tells Dingo to come to his office. Upon doing so, Noman wants Dingo to join him again. Dingo refuses and ends up getting shot in the heart and lungs by Noman. That's a really good shot from the back if you got all of that. But as Dingo starts dying in the hallway, a frame runner, Ken Marineris, who fought Dingo back at Callisto, wants him to help her. 2 months later, Ken revives Dingo back to life and tells him that his heart and lungs are gone, and to stay alive, he has to remain inside Jehuti's cockpit as Ada provides the life support. Now Dingo knows that from Ken, if he wants his normal body back, he must cooperate with Ken. Can Dingo complete his mission, kill Noman, destroy Anubis, and get his normal body back? And that answer is, of course, yes. But along the way, he has to save Taper, fight Leo, take down a shield, kill Viola, who's now a battle AI, save a city, destroy a train, kill Viola again, delete Viola, again, because she's an AI, play Simon Says, fight Lloyd, fight some flying battleships for some reason, fight an all-out war, become awesome, fight the fake Anubis, lose his awesome powers, fight the real Anubis in some sort of hyperspeed light stream, and then fight Anubis again before everything just explodes. That's a decent summary of the game, right?
Mm-hmm. So, and you did, however, forget the... Admittedly, they're optional, but you do get to fight and kill more Violas at the end before the final fight.
Sure. I honestly do not understand why Noman would clone out a battle AI of a woman who failed to defeat Jehuti being piloted by a kid who had never piloted any orbital frame ever before. Like, of all the people, mm-hmm. why? Why not clone yourself? I don't get it. Anyways, there's a lot of weird stuff with that. And part of it I want to go into a little bit more specifically. That scene where Dingo leaves Jehuti to go to Noman's office. At the beginning of the game, all we know about Dingo is that he's an ice harvester on a moon orbiting Jupiter. And he cares about sports ball on Mars for some reason. And then he finds Jehuti, who's been abandoned here because, I guess, piecing stuff together, Leo somehow convinced the Space Force to drop Jehuti here on the moon instead of letting her complete her mission.
I kind of got the impression that he didn't convince them to do anything. He was just like, hey, if I give them Jehuti, then they'll make her go blow up, so I'll just seal her in a crate and drop her on the moon.
I don't get it. So yeah, Bahram, for some reason, attacks at this opportune time. He fights Ken Marineris, then boards the Bahram ship, gets into a fight with Viola's battle AI, and this is the first clue that he has some history with Bahram, mm-hmm. in that he knows who Viola is. Explained, kind of. And then he gets into a fight with Anubis, is utterly defeated, not even a fair fight. And then, for reasons I don't understand, agrees to Noman's request to meet him in the office, leaves Jehuti, and then, while walking through a hallway in the Bahram ship, because I guess he knows where this office is on a ship that they've been using for over 6 years, Noman introduces Dingo to Ken Marineris through fun exposition as to who Dingo is and what his past is, that 6 years ago he left and was registered as dead. And then kind of commands Dingo to join Bahram again. Like, hey, your skills have sucked. Like, you're in this awesome Jehuti and you still can't defeat me. You suck, but I want you to fight alongside me again. And when Dingo refuses, because of course he refuses, he's a good guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
He gets shot in the back. And it's a pretty epic anime cutscene of just blood in zero G flying everywhere. But none of this scene makes sense. And it's all made worse by the terrible dubbing that this early 2000s or mid 2000s game. Early. It's 2003, right?
That's early. I think early. So. That sounds about right.
But yeah, terrible dubbing. And I don't understand any of this. Why? Why did he board this ship? Dingo. Why did Dingo board this ship? Why was Bahram even at Callisto? I don't understand any of this. None of this makes sense. It's like terrible writing, and I don't get it.
Yeah. His reasoning for getting on the ship was like, they're looking for Jehuti, so if I just get on their ship, then they'll leave Callisto. But he didn't, like, get on to give them Jehuti. He got on the ship to keep fighting. And then...
But why does Bahram even need Jehuti? They obviously don't.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's... None of this makes sense. And a lot of this, like, proceeds throughout the entire game as to what the story just not making sense.
Mm-hmm.
But this particularly, like, none of this Callisto stuff makes any sense.
So
yeah, it looks cool though.
Yeah, my favorite part of the story, one of my favorite parts of the game actually, was the point where you get another SOS mission, like the ones that were in the original game. And I just thought, like I said, my favorite part of the first game was that character development between Leo and Ada, where, you know, Leo sort of realized that he had to buckle down and fight to save people, and he got Ada to realize that human life is, you know, life in general is important and valuable. And so when you actually get to, I forget the name of the city, but the city where the Space Force is fighting, Dingo, and this is just after you meet Leo in Zone of the Enders 2 as well. So after meeting him and finding out that he was the previous runner, Dingo says, like, oh, these guys are fighting in the middle of a civilian city. We need to stop the fighting and save the civilians. And Ada's like, yep, okay, I'll mark all of the civilian buildings. I recommend using the geyser to disable. And it's like, oh yeah, she's, not only does she know how to assist with this, she, like, is not going to argue with you because she understands Dingo's desire to prevent casualties as much as possible. And when you finish the mission, if you're not perfect, which of course I wasn't, she even goes out of her way to say, you know, you did the best you could. It was, you know, good that you saved 80% of the civilians given these circumstances.
Oh, you saved a lot more of the civilians than I did.
I think it was 80%, something like that. It was weird because during the battle, she said half of the buildings have been destroyed, and then at the end of the battle, it said 80% survived, or 80% of the buildings.
Weird.
But I thought that that was a great follow-up to the first game, and Dingo even points out, like, I think what he says is, oh, so you're the kind of lady who will, you know, change her view to make the man that she loves happy.
Yep. Yep, she does. But, I mean, she's an AI, so...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On that particular note, what I think is hilarious is that it's the Space Force that do most of the destruction. I mean, you can as well, but, mm-hmm. Yeah, the Space Force is just constantly firing at the buildings for some reason. They're really good at their job, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I kind of want to bring up one of the things that I liked about this game in general is that the first game, there's like the three main SOS. I want to say there were three SOS missions that were kind of optionary, but I don't think they really were. Because I think you had to go to some of them to get certain weapons to proceed, or keys or something. But it was very much the same. Like, each of those were the same. But in this game, I feel like each chapter had something unique about it. So you, like this SOS, you really only did this particular SOS style mission the one time.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. So that's a cool thing. They definitely figured out how to provide variety in this giant mech combat game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also really liked that. And there were a lot of sub-weapons in Zone of the Enders 1, but in Zone of the Enders 2, those sub-weapons were a lot more useful, which meant that I used them a lot more and there was more variety in that sense. Like the gauntlet, which was always useful for punching through shields at a distance, but it was also more effective depending on the environment, because if you punch someone into a wall, they take double damage. And maybe it did in the original, but there was a note in the second one that the shield that you bring up when you use Mummy, which is your healing power, will block things you couldn't block with your normal shield.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
So, yeah, it was just the fact that they were more useful, and I ended up switching my sub-weapons around a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And the geyser was in the first one, but it was just something that would stick to the wall or the floor, and most of the battles were not next
anywhere
to the wall
near
or
those.
The floor.
Yeah.
So, in the second one, geyser, it could also do that, but its main purpose was that it would stun enemies that were not blocking at the moment.
Kind of trap them.
Yeah. And so just the fact that they made those sub-weapons useful meant there was a lot more variety in the combat because I had a lot more options.
They also all look pretty cool. Like, I'd have a hard time differentiating some of the first games versus, like, Gauntlet versus Javelin versus some of those others. Whatever the sniper one was called. Maybe that was called Javelin.
It was Sniper.
But yeah, they all looked and felt very similar to each other. But in this game, they are all unique. And some of them, like, my favorite was the pretty late game homing missiles, which just the way that they would populate behind you and then fire off looks and feels really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that kind of leads into what I really liked about Zone of the Enders 2. The combat feeling so much faster and how I would describe as kinetic than what the first game allowed for. The first game, it was very much one-on-one fights. Even if there were a crowd of them, for the most part, it was always just zeroing in on one-to-one. But this game was almost always like large swarms of enemies mm-hmm. that you would just be flying through, bouncing from one enemy to another, and the experience is just really fast and fun. Some of my favorite moments in this game were when I was able to get into that like rhythm of combat of grabbing enemies, using them to beat someone, then throwing them into someone that's far away or into the wall, and it's just like everything's going on and no battle is like the exact same. It's mm-hmm. just, it's a dance, and it's really a cool thing that they were able to do this, in at all. Just, it's a really cool game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the bosses had a lot of variety too. I thought I actually really liked the, that sort of, I don't know if he was supposed to be an engineer or martial arts master or what his deal was, but the guy that gave you the zero shift and the way that in the second half of the battle, in the second half of the battle, he makes the entire room completely dark and you just have to listen to what Ada is telling you to do. And it was just a nice little twist that you're sort of, like you said, you're playing Simon Says until you get close enough to the enemy to attack.
Oh, I kind of, when I said Simon Says, mm-hmm. I actually meant the scene getting to Lloyd when Ken is telling you, okay, go right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, go left, like avoiding all the mines. But yeah, it sort of mm-hmm. also does that there with Ada saying, incoming attack to the right or something like that, and you just have to dodge out of the way. And that is actually one of my favorite battles, too. Against Lloyd, who I think he's actually described as the main scientist for Barum and one of the guys who designed like all of the weapons and possibly even designed Jehuti and / Anubis. Kind of unsure on that, but he's the like the genius behind everything for some reason. Mm-hmm. Is how I took it.
He was just presented in a very martial arts master kind of way where you show up and he says you must prove yourself.
He came off as a father figure to me, but to Dingo, a father figure to Dingo.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that I mm-hmm. thoroughly enjoyed about this game, or at least one of my like fun moments, was again combat related, the massive field battle. I remember when Kingdom Hearts 2 came out, it was a big deal that they had a giant swarm of enemies in that game. And I didn't look up which one did it first, but Zone of the Enders 2 has that same sort of like, here's just a giant battlefield full of enemies and allies that you're again just flying around and you have to, it's a SOS style mission of like, you have to at both times be in the combat itself, but also trying to protect your allies and like heal them. And it's just, there's a lot going on, but it really exemplifies to me like where this game shines, as far as the gameplay and, not necessarily the story. I don't think the story ever shines in this game, but the gameplay, the visuals, mm-hmm. like everything looks nice. and plays really surprisingly smooth when there's this many enemies on screen. It was fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I also, you know, we've talked and I'm sure we'll talk more about the story, but I liked the characters. I liked Leo and Ada in the first one, and but Dingo had an interesting personal story that you kind of found out about, that of why he's, you know, why he left Baram, and then why he's now, you know, he didn't really want to, but now that he's back, he's taking revenge on Noman.
In more ways than one, like, for multiple reasons. Not yes. only did Noman in this game shoot him in the back, destroying his heart and lungs, but also, Noman was a giant dick to him 6 years ago, too. To him and his entire squad. Which really just left me wondering why Noman kept Ken Marinaris at his side the entire time. Like, I don't get Noman at all. I don't get Ken at all. I don't know. I couldn't grow to like either of them, but Dingo is cool. Like, he mm-hmm. is a fun protagonist to play as.
And the definitely compared to the sort of 3D in the first Zone of the Enders, which kind of reminded me of, well, it's like a lot of like late PS1, early PS2 games that had the pre-rendered 3D cutscenes that kind of reminded me of Reboot. Compared to that, the anime cutscenes and the sort of codec conversations, as you called them, were great, and I think helped drive the connection to the characters, because you weren't just like the cockpit as you know, sort of place to have conversations was an interesting idea, and that did make it feel like a codec, but actually being able to see the people talking helped a lot.
Even though the lips never sank.
No, they didn't.
I really loved the art style of this game. The fact that they went with that more traditional anime style instead of that, the 3D CGI models of the first game. I think that was a really smart choice. And that it was consistent throughout. And just the designs of everything, like each area looks unique. Each robot is really unique. I still love the design of Jehuti. That's Jehuti's one of those, Gunpla models. Like, I want to get a model kit of Jehuti someday. There was one a couple of years ago, many years ago at this point, that I almost bought, but I didn't have, the ability to then get it home at the time. And I keep looking for another one, because I really want a model of Jehuti. Just that design is awesome, and I want to have that. But even just like the music and everything else, it's a really good stylistic game. Mm-hmm. In much the same way most of the Metal Gear Solid series is.
Mm-hmm. All right, so, well, I think that's everything on our like list. So what did you not like about the game?
As I kind of said before, the dubbing in this is awful. Like, I want to say that the dubbing in this second game is worse than the first game, and the first game isn't good either. I don't know who did the dubbing, but I hope they aren't in business anymore. I mean, it's nice that the voice actors from the first game returned. Like, that's a quality mm-hmm. thing. Good job on that, but none of them are good. And that probably is why I don't care about most of their characters.
I can't think of any examples now, but there were just a lot of really awkward translations that were just like, wow, you didn't even try to rewrite that to make it sound like something an English-speaking person would say. You just took whatever they said in Japanese and just had someone read it out loud with no rewrite.
And what really got to me was Dingo's voice actor, or at least the director for it, maybe, but he'll be yelling or really upset one moment, mm-hmm. and then be just monotone the next of, okay, now we have to go do this. It's like, yeah. no, that's it's just really like whiplash in tone a lot of the times. Really bad dubbing.
mm-hmm.
How about you?
Yeah, so like we've said before, and I'm just gonna go into it now. The story just a lot of it made absolutely no sense. They wanted to blow up Aomon, which was the enemy base, but then it wasn't a base; it was a super weapon. But then when you get there, it's not actually a super weapon. It's a control system, which for some reason had to be the size of a fortress. But it's a control system for the real Aomon, which is an orbital laser. But then they blow up the control system with the laser, but it's not actually supposed to be a laser. The real purpose is to destroy the entire solar system. It just around the time you got to the what you thought was going to be Aomon, and they were like, it's a control system. I just checked out, and I was mostly checked out on the story by then anyway. I'm like, all right, you say whatever you want. I don't even care.
At about the midpoint in the game, they describe, I can't remember what the weapon is called now, but you need this like special laser in order to mm-hmm. break through the special like gravity
the vector cannon.
You need the vector cannon to break through the shields. And they have a Kojima moment of explaining how the shields work and why the vector cannon cancels out the shields. And I'm like, I would have never noticed this the first time I played it, but now I totally understand why they go so in depth into explaining this ridiculous thing right here.
Right. It's like halfway through the game, they have this long cutscene to explain everything that's going on. And then also half of that is, well, not quite contradicted, but it makes even less sense when you find out later that what you're actually infiltrating is a control system.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was... it was not good.
No.
And I just ignored it.
So something else that I kind of disliked about this game was how very weak you are made in the beginning of this game. And it's even more exemplified when you get the Zero Shift and you are finally awesome. But the fact that, so you're Jehuti, you're the second best orbital mm-hmm. frame ever built. And yet, in the very beginning of this game, a group of raptors, like the most basic of units, can just shoot you out of the sky and kill you in no time flat. Like, just, they'll surround you and kill you. And I don't know about you, but, like, this very early moment in the Balram ship, I died multiple times against just two waves of raptors. Mm-hmm. Until I finally realized that at least for me, the way to beat them was to grab one of them and use them as my sword, because for some reason, the raptor unit will just break through their shields, whereas my regular energy sword, the sword, does not. And that really kind of irked mm-hmm. me, that they have these difficulty spikes that, not fun.
Yeah, so I only started the game a week ago, and I beat the first zone of the Enders before then and started the second one a week ago. And before I started, you suggested if I was running out of time, I might want to just start the game on easy, since you can't change it partway through.
I couldn't figure out a way, and I kind of wanted to.
mm-hmm. And I thought about it, but then I started it on standard, and like it took me so many tries to get through that escape from the ship. Which I guess, I don't know if you were talking about the getting into the ship or escaping after he was revived.
It's right after he's revived and you get Geyser.
Okay.
Like, and it's that very first wave of raptors where Ada's like, use Geyser to like trap them and better maintain them. But mm-hmm. I would use Geyser until I was out of subweapon energy, and I still couldn't beat them because by the time I actually, like, destroyed one of them, the rest of them would be free and killing me. I just,
I wasn't that exact spot, but I got stuck on another spot where you had to, it was a couple of hallways in a row that you had to fight through, and after getting stuck on that for most of a night, I decided if I couldn't, well, I did finally get through it the next night, but I was on the verge of just restarting the whole game on easy.
The moment for me on that was the Vic Viper fight, which I was putting this down as a particular moment that frustrated me. But he's the first fight you have, basically, after leaving the Bahram ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Vic Viper's being piloted by Leo. And it's a kind of cool moment because he's like saying stuff about Jehuti and getting Jehuti slash Ada back. Which of course wouldn't make sense to Dingo at the time, but like, it's a cool fight, but he is just so overpowered in health and damage ability that it's just a slog to get through on normal difficulty. At least it was for me. And that was the moment where I was looking at the options, trying to find a way to lessen the difficulty, and I was getting really close to just starting over because at really sucked for me, at least. I really hated that fight.
That took me several tries. I don't think I got quite as frustrated as you because I don't know exactly why, but I think I got less annoyed with it when I realized that it wasn't just like an arbitrary amount of time you had to wait for him to fly around. There was a pattern and you could count and know when to
yes
attack him because he was getting ready to switch back. And so it did have the same problem I had with some of the other bosses, though, especially one of the Anubis fights, which is that it's just too long. You including Vic Viper, there are some fights where like each attack you do barely damages them, and if you get hit once, it takes out a quarter of your health. And some of the attacks feel like, oh, I know how to dodge this, but some of the time, through no control of my own, it just won't work and I'll get hit. Because it's like kind of like his Vic Viper's ripple or wave or whatever he called it.
Yeah, you're supposed to fly through the center of it, but that becomes really difficult. When there are then those like mimics behind him that are also generating that thing, and then they overlap, and you can't really go through the center.
Yeah, I would just try to, you know, do a dash to the side, which was how you dodge pretty much everything, and that would
everything work else, but
75% of the time. And I had the same problem with the fight with Anubis on the beam to.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what I was going to bring up.
He does this, like the main attack he uses in that fight is, surrounds himself with these weird blood particles, which mean that you can't just zero shift over to him like you can in most of the fights after you get it. And he fires a red ball at you that's kind of sort of homing. And I just couldn't tell the difference between dodging correctly and I get out of the way or dodging incorrectly and it hits me, and so I would just have to very slowly chip away at his health and hope that I didn't just happen to get hit by that too many times.
The first several times I fought against Anubis there, I was zero shifting in when he was starting that attack, and I would say it was about a 50% chance that I could get in there successfully and attack, or I would just get bounced away, and I could not tell what the difference was but between the times that I was able to get in there and the times that I would get bounced and damaged trying.
See, I just gave up on that. For most of that fight, I would just wait for him to attack, try to dodge, and then shift in and attack. And he used that attack, maybe it's some kind of thing where he was reacting to my behavior and me keeping my distance, but it seemed like most of the time he would just use that attack in...
Yes.
In the few times that he did something else, I could shift in, but most of that fight was me waiting for him to do that one attack so I could hopefully dodge and shift in and attack him. And it would have been a neat little learn the best way to, you know, to respond to his pattern if it didn't take so long and have to restart every time and take so long again every time I died.
Yeah. And all of those bosses have a ridiculous amount of health compared to Jehuti.
Mm-hmm.
For that Anubis fight, what I found to work as far as dodging was actually to, I mean, that's one of the neat things about this combat system is that you're flying, so you can go up and down. And so mm-hmm. I eventually figured out that if I go down and left at the same time, that I would, like, 90% of the time, dodge successfully. If I was just going left or right, mm-hmm. it was what you're describing, but if I was going down at the same time and could get underneath, he would miss. And
mm-hmm.
that was
I
how I
tried
that
a few times
that.
Too, and that I think that helped me with Vic Viper, but with Anubis, I tried dodging up or down as well as left or right a few times, and I got hit a couple times and decided it wasn't helping.
Hmm. I think the final, when I finally beat him, I had stopped dashing entirely, or the zero shifting entirely. I was mm-hmm. I was just regular movement, which is really annoying because in that fight, you've lost everything else you can do. You don't have, like, any sub-weapons except for zero shift. You can't shield yourself. You don't have any of your, like, super charged weapons or anything like that. So it was this boss fight where I was just awesome, and now all I can do is like dash forward and then attack or dodge a little bit. But it's a really sucky fight.
Mm-hmm.
Another fight that you said you felt like you were waiting a lot. The fight that I felt like I was waiting a lot was when Ken Marineris, whatever her orbital frame is, gets mm-hmm. Attacked by the or overwritten by the Viola AI, and so the only way to be able to grab her is to deflect in a combo her sword attack, parry them,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm just standing there waiting for her to attack with her sword, and that's all I can do. And it sucks. And what was even better on that is that sometimes she would just start eating mm-hmm. Ken Marineris' health. So then I'd have to attack. And
that was
such a slow and boring
fight. That was a
fight
where I will admit that after a couple tries, I said, whatever I'm doing, it's not working. I can't delete the AI faster than she's hurting herself. So I went to a guide to look up what to do there, and the answer is you just need to basically stay close to her, and
yeah,
she won't do the self-attack.
That's not 100% true, though, but yes, overall, if you're ever, like, out of sight, it'll definitely happen.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what I thought was nice is that in a lot of these fights, or a lot of the chapters in general, Ada gives you a suggestion of, like, what your plan of attack should be, or what sub-weapons to focus mm-hmm. on. That was really nice.
Yeah.
Something else that Metal Gear Solid kind of does in its codex if you go into them optionally. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Something else particularly noteworthy for you?
So, we did talk about it, but the part where you get the zero shift module, and it also upgrades your attacks and your defenses, and you just become super powerful, and they give you a significantly sized level where you're just fighting waves of enemies and you just tear through them, and like
yeah.
anytime they try to counterattack, you just appear behind them, and that was great. I really like it when games let you do that. Really, you feel really powerful before they inevitably either, you know, throw you against even more powerful enemies that can match you, or strip your powers again, which this game did both of right after that level.
The epitome for this like trope or whatever is still the supercharged gravity gun in Half-Life 2.
Yes.
But yes, I love it when games give you that moment of, hey, you are now awesome. Experience how it is to be awesome. I do really enjoy that, and they did a pretty good job of that here. So something that I wanted to bring up as a noteworthy moment is that this was a replay for me, and I remember, like, one of the few memories I still retained of this game was how much I hated both the train and battleship sections, and I personally feel like both of those sections still really suck.
I actually loved the battleship. The train was okay. It was another thing that kind of went on longer than it needed to, but I loved the battleship section. It was also, I mean, it to a lesser extent, it also felt like a moment of being really powerful because they just gave you the homing missiles, which can just take out any regular orbital frames that are nearby.
See, that was what I actually hated about it, though, is that the homing missiles just completely drain out your sub-weapon. So yeah, you can destroy everything, but then you don't have enough sub-weapon energy to use your vector cannon to destroy the battleships. So I was then getting stuck of, well, I have to go to another battleship hoping that a Raptor is there that has sub-weapon energy, and because it was super annoying for me.
I ever ran into that problem on that level. I wasn't even sure that the vector cannon used the sub-weapon energy, because every time I got there, I had filled up from killing more of the Raptors that kept attacking.
Maybe I was just doing it wrong, but I just did not have a good time with either of those sections. Either time I played it.
I just thought it felt really cool, because it was like a scaling up of... you're not just fighting mechs one-on-one. You have these huge battleships that are, you know, launching defenses at you, and you're just going from one to the other and tearing apart their defenses, and then you sit down and you charge up and just blow up the whole ship. And there were a couple where it will close when you get close to the engine.
Yep.
So you have to destroy the other things on the front of the ship to prevent it from closing.
Yep.
And I figured out that if I could, take out the weapons that could hit me on top, except for the main cannon, I could go around back and it would start closing. And then I swing around to the front and sit down and start charging my vector cannon pointed at the main cannon, and it would be ready by the time it closed and then opened and then started to fire, and it would actually blow up the whole ship, because it would shoot through the main cannon and then the engine behind it.
Huh.
So that felt pretty awesome.
That sounds so much easier than my method. My method was, because I didn't want to waste my sub-weapon energy, I would, for a good while, just be using the dash multi-shot to destroy stuff. And then when it was finally down to just, which took a long time, but to the main, like, front cannon, I would then get to, like, the corner where it's not able to hit me, but it's still open. And I would just do the standing still, supercharged energy ball attack thing. And a couple hits of that will eventually kill it.
And then I
could go round back and do the vector cannon.
I did the homing lasers, which is the dash lasers,
for
all of the defenses on the ship on the front. So I would just kind of go back and forth and dodge a lot and shoot at all of those at once. And then I would save the homing missiles for any other orbital frames that showed up. And usually it would be a squad that one of them would have sub-weapon energy. So that was all I saved my energy for, was to immediately kill these three, and then for the vector cannon.
Somehow, on your first play, you found a far better strategy for that chapter than I did on my second. Good job. The last thing that I particularly wanted to bring up as a moment that I got super excited about was that Massive Battlefield chapter that I brought up earlier as like one of those, in my opinion, moments of like showing how awesome the combat was. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so when I got to the ranking screen and it said that I got the S rank, I was like, yeah, damn right I did. Wait, why didn't a trophy go off? I should have got a trophy if I just got the S
you
rank.
You wanted the SS rank.
Oh, ah! What the hell rank is that?
See, I didn't know about the SS rank, but I was of the opinion that I was going to, like, figure out how to do it and then do it with zero casualties. And then when I finally... Well, I mean, it took a while. I didn't have to restart, but, you know, after it took a while and I finally completed it, it was, you know, in the 80 or 90 range, I was like, eh, that's good enough. Which I think was also an S rank, but you have to get 100% for SS.
I am sorry, but that's ridiculous. So anything else you wanted to bring up?
Nope.
Okay, so, yeah, wrapping up time. Oh, what did we think about this game? David, tell me what you thought about Zone of the Enders 1 and 2.
So we both said it a lot. The number one word is style. It's a very stylish game, and a lot of fast action, and the story didn't matter much, but the characters were easy to get attached to. I'm really glad that I went back and replayed the original and I finally got to complete the story. I'd love to see another game in this style, maybe with different characters since, and you know, a different mech since the story with Jehudi and Anubis is complete. But overall, I thoroughly enjoyed it, even with the bumps.
Yeah, I loved the style of this game as well. I loved the designs of the mechs, and I loved the world that they kind of built around it. This whole, like, Metatron and, the space stations and this war between Mars and Space Force. And, like, I feel like they put some thought, at least a little bit, behind this world and how it works and how these mechs would work and how they fight. And like, there's some really awesome ideas and they did a really great job of executing the actual action of it. This second game, the combat system is just it has some really fun moments. Once you, figure out, all of the different ways, the sub weapons, the grabbing, all of that, it really works well together. And I would love to see them revisit, well, or at least someone in that sort of like team come back and revisit. It doesn't have to be Kojima himself, but there had to have been plenty of talented people here that could come back for this type of a game.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I agree that I hope they come up with new weapons. Like maybe they do, 100 years later or something where it's like completely new setup and they can bring some true originality, but still somehow have that same feel of combat. It would be a lot of fun. And something that was nice about replaying this game, that I definitely want to mention again, if I didn't, articulate it well before, was just that now that I have that history of knowing what Metal Gear Solid was, who Kojima was and his style, like it was really cool replaying these games and seeing that influence and just that style, like seeing it done in a true mech game. It was a lot of fun. I'm really glad that I was able to replay this game and that you joined me on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sort of Kojima style, or maybe his team more than him alone, was definitely all over these games with the mech designs that were, sort of like the way that the Metal Gears started going around Metal Gear Ray, that, you know, with sort of mechanical but looking animalistic, and
yeah,
right down to the sound effects on the menus were the same as the Metal Gear Solid sound effects.
The game over screen, like all of it, is definitely the same style.
That reminds me, just another side note of something that I just remembered that I thought was great was when you're fighting Lloyd and die, the game over screen has him go, "Okay, Dingo. Dingo? I overdid it."
That was like one of the few boss fights that I did not die against, so. Oh. I think it was that one and the giant one after the battleships.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like the two bosses that I did not die at least once against. Oh, the first fight against Anubis, the fake Anubis.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't die there either. But yeah,
all right.
That was fun. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for suggesting it. Like I said, that was sort of in the back of my head for a long time.
And now, yeah, we can go back to waiting for a game that will never happen because Konami certainly doesn't have interest in this series anymore. But keeping the mech theme going, ADE Game Club's game for June will be Titanfall 2, a game that I have heard nothing but praise for, even though it sold probably like 100 copies. Like, no one's talking about it anymore, but I've heard so many good things, and I've heard some of the game critics I most highly respect have said that Titanfall 2's single player story is one of their favorites of all time. So I am excited to find out what this game does to warrant that kind of praise.
Yeah, I've definitely, I think we said before, I'm not that into sort of the general shooter type games, or maybe it wasn't on the podcast, but I said that in a conversation fairly recently, and that's what I thought that Titanfall and Titanfall 2 would be, but I just heard so much praise for the single-player story of Titanfall 2 that was one of the games that I bought right after getting a PS4. So
same here.
I'm excited to play it.
Yep. So yeah, please play along with us next month, and our next episode is planned for release on June 25th. And that will do it. Have a good one. And after show is some Kickstarter talk, because there was some bad news in my Kickstarter game feed about a month or two ago that I wanted to vent about. So I suggested this as a topic. And David agreed for whatever reason. So maybe he had something he wants to talk about Kickstarter woes as well, but like, I have not kickstarted a whole lot of games. My history was, of course, I think everyone's history as far as Kickstarter probably started because of the Double Fine Adventure game, which was eventually branded as Broken Age. Right? For you as well, David?
Oh, no, So I was going to say, you have a list of, I assume this is most of the projects that you've, or
every
video games.
Every game I have kickstarted is on this list.
I checked my Kickstarter page, and I have backed 212 projects, not all of which fully funded.
Wow! I have, like, two games that I like, put money on, but they didn't finish, so I didn't actually pay. But, yeah, I have, like, two failed projects that I tried to fund.
So my actually, I think the very first project that I backed was for a basically comic book called Poorcraft that's like a guide to living cheaply, which I backed when I was a poor college student, and I didn't actually get it for a couple years later, but it is a nice little book with like recipes and thrifty shopping tips and what have you. The first game Kickstarter though, which I backed, which was the next one that I backed, was No Time to Explain,
Oh
which
yeah, I remember that one.
the original game that came out was, I liked it. It was fun, but it was also really buggy, and but as a result of the game, the company Tiny Build ended up becoming a publisher of other games, and they've actually become a pretty big, well, like in the realm of indie games, they've become pretty big, and they've published a lot of other games, and they eventually went back and just recreated No Time to Explain from scratch, and added things like four-player co-op and the game not running on flash and crashing all the time, and other useful features. So even though the original release was kind of a mess, I'm pretty proud to have backed that and helped create the company Tiny Build.
Only the ones that have betrayed my trust I have any like negative feelings about. So yeah, I have a pretty short list in comparison, and I can very quickly go through those of games that I've funded and have received. I have the Double Fine Adventure, Broken Age, Among the Sleep, which I haven't played any of these that I'm going to list here. Among the Sleep, Planetary Annihilation, Republique, which not only did I fund this game, but I decided to go the like extra higher tier where I was supposed to get a physical journal like of text from within the game or something. I don't even know. But it was thanks to going through this list that I realized that, hey, I never got this reward that I paid extra money for on top of the game. So I actually contacted their support, and within 2 days they sent out my journal to
Oh,
me, which
wow.
I thought that was pretty cool. So yeah, that if you've funded a game and forgotten that you should have gotten some physical stuff from it, like maybe follow up. That's something I learned just now. But yeah, I also funded Cosmic Star Heroine and Hyper Light Drifter. Like, all of these games I want to play, but I have yet to play yet. But I have received them, so that's cool. And then the one game that I funded and did receive and have actually played was the Shantae Half Genie Hero, which was fun. Like, it was short. It was a lot shorter than I honestly expected, but it was fun.
And I also have a lot of games that I've backed and got it, and I just haven't gotten around to playing it. Also, Planetary Annihilation, which I think I may never get around to playing just because the my interest in my already short-lived interest in real-time strategy games has dissipated since then, but it did look like a solid game, and also Republic and Cosmic Star Heroine, which I've started but haven't gotten very far into. Also, the Banner Saga, which I think is up to kickstarting their third game now, and again, it looks
Sounds
fantastic,
right.
but it's like the kind of game that you would need to dedicate a lot of time to, in that it's very story heavy and tactical. Turn-based tactical strategy game. And so I would really like to play that one, and it's just not gotten around to it.
For my list that I listed out, like all of these games except for maybe Planetary Annihilation and Among the Sleep, but the Broken Age, high on my list. Republic, high on my list. Cosmic Star Heroine, very high on my list. Hyper Light Drifter, again, high on my list. I want to play these games. I haven't found the time, because there's, like, I borrow games like Dishonored 2 from you, and it's like, I'm loving that game right now, and on top of Persona 5, on top of Pokemon, on top of all of these other big games, on top of the 80 Game Club games, like, I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then there's Mighty Number 9, which, of course, is a...
Oh, yes!
Famously Clusterfuck, which...
I'm so glad I did not fund that one.
You know what? I did play a little bit of it, and it wasn't terrible, but it was just not that fun. And I said, I'll probably come back to this later, and I didn't. And I feel almost an obligation just because of how infamously... I still don't think it's as, you know, horribly bad as I've heard it is, but I don't think I will actually end up going back, because I just don't have the time to play a really mediocre game, that especially one that broke my heart after so much hype, that it would be, you know, just like the Mega Man games of old.
The only game recently that I almost funded but decided against was the one by the Castlevania guy, which I'm blanking on the name now. Something like Broken something, I don't even remember.
Oh,
it's not,
yeah,
Broken.
Bloodstained.
It started with a B. Bloodstained, yeah. That game looked promising, as far as, like, there haven't really been good Castlevania games in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I think the DS, or maybe was it 3DS series? I know it was definitely the DS series was pretty good. I don't remember if there was a 3DS series of Castlevania games or not that were good. Anyways, sidetracking here. So games that I funded, and why I've basically stopped funding games on Kickstarter and would rather just wait till they're out. Star Citizen. I have downloaded the beta and played that a couple of times for like an hour. And it looks cool, but it does not run well. And it's so confusing. Like, you need a guide in order to figure out what you can and can't do, or how to get to stuff. Because it is so... Like, they're building a world where you're supposed to roleplay in, so if you want to go out into space, you need to first get a suit, a space suit. But where do you get a space suit? You have to, and none of those, like, in-game tutorials or pointers or anything were, at least at the time I played it, were in the game yet. Mm-hmm. So you needed to have, like, a guide in order to know what you could do in this beta, and that just wasn't fun to me. Mega Tokyo visual novel game. I knew exactly what I was getting into there, and I accepted the fact that I wouldn't see that for years. The Soul Saga was one where it was just this fan of JRPGs. He had that passion that convinced me to throw him at least a couple of dollars. So I did that. That game has changed so much from what he was originally advertising it to be, though, that I've kind of lost hope on enjoying that. But who knows? Maybe it'll be decent. Probably not. Psychonauts 2, which is technically Fig, but like, that's another one that's going to probably take forever. But it could come out and be awesome. I really need to play Broken Age and find out how good that was or was not. But the one that broke my heart, and is why I've stopped, like, definitely stopped funding these Kickstarters, is Project Phoenix. The game, the JRPG game that was advertised as, like, bringing all of the JRPG development legends of old, people like Nobuo and several other people from the Square Enix teams that we loved back in the day, who are not Tetsuya Nomura, like, it was supposed to be awesome, and it was advertised so well. And the art style, the music that they were teasing, I was so in on this game. I went with a high tier. I wanted this game. And then it went silent, which most of these Kickstarters do. It went silent, and eventually they announced that they're experiencing delays. And recently, like within the last year, it was announced that a lot of all of these delays were because the plan that was not made public to the Kickstarters, mm-hmm. but the plan was that they had signed on the lead developer, the lead programmer, was going to be the same guy who was the lead developer of Ori and the Blind Forest. But wouldn't you know it? After the guy completed Ori and the Blind Forest, and it was a pretty big success, like, fans loved it, critics loved it, like, it was a well-received game from what I've been told. I haven't played it. But, like, he did really well there, and then I think Microsoft offered him a really juicy contract, and he took that instead of working for this Kickstarter that he non-contractually agreed to work on. And so, instead of, like, being clear with the Kickstarter people, they tried to hide this for months.
Ooh.
And eventually just had to come clean of, yeah, our lead programmer bailed on us, and we can't get anyone else, so the project is going on hold. And then I think it was about two months ago or so that they announced, yeah, that game that we already funded is still on hold and probably is never going to happen. But come kickstart our other game now, which, if it's successful, will possibly help us fund that Project Phoenix game that was already funded. And I'm just, that was the moment where I was like, I need to vent. I can't believe that this is allowed. And I got that. Basically, Project Phoenix is why I no longer kickstart games. I would rather just wait. Like, even treating it as a pre-order system, I'm not okay with anymore. I'd rather just wait and see if the game is good. I will buy it for full price eventually when I have time to actually play it. But I don't need to be pre-ordering a game that won't come out for 2 years after they say it will, and who knows if it's going to be good or not. I don't need to do that anymore.
I've backed a lot of Kickstarters, and
rant
a
over.
Lot of them have not worked out, and I've been backing a lot less in the last couple of years, but that's, you know, partly because of trust and partly because I've been realizing, like, wow, I've, you know, should not be spending this much money on things that may or may not come to pass. But it was never like a big, that's it, I'm done, no more moment. And I do have a funny story. I should probably not say what this Kickstarter is, because I have, like, some not super juicy, but I think interesting background info, which was I joined a project to basically make a game. It was a webcomic author that I like that said, like, hey, I've got this plan for a game. Who wants to help me? And I have very little experience programming games, but I would, you know, really like to do that. So I volunteered, and he had a lead programmer, and I was like, hey, maybe I can help out.
I think I remember you telling me about this one.
Yeah. So what was interesting was that I was in the sort of Skype conversation with was myself, the main programmer, and several artists, and a designer, I think. I really don't remember all of them, but the discussion was basically that there would be this big big RPG that, you know, he had a lot of people, he had the story planned out and the characters, and it was going to be great, and there was going to be this twist, and but everybody knew that this would be a really big game to make, and it would be an iffy project to kickstart with this team that has never done anything like this. So the idea was to make a short, small game that could be like proof.
A prologue.
A prologue, and we could figure out how to work together as a team, and we could also prove that Well, it's like a, not a direct prologue, but like something with the same sort of same universe, different characters kind of thing. Or I think maybe some of the characters would show up, but it was like just a side game. And there were a lot of ideas bounced back and forth, but the ideas sort of ranged from, oh, it will, how about like an automatic runner on the phone, to somehow we got, or I mean, I didn't really contribute much to the discussion, which is why I kind of quietly dropped out of the project. I didn't feel like I was contributing anything, and I definitely didn't want to get involved in like a Kickstarter where I wasn't, you know, wasn't sure I'd be able to help at all, and there would be money involved. But anyway, the folks that were on the project, somehow the idea of a very simple and easy to complete game turned into a roguelike dungeon crawler with...
Of course it did.
That's already far, far more than should be a, you know, practice project. It's a roguelike dungeon crawler with relationship mechanics for all of the people that you could recruit, as well as customizing your town and your house in the town, and getting loot so that you, that's like furniture you could put in your house, and every minor character that you could recruit would have a story with, or they could get into relationships with other characters as well as you. And it was really interesting to have this perspective of watching that sort of feature bloat happen as it went wildly outside the original plan.
Which is actually the downfall of most Kickstarter games.
Yeah.
So pretty good they went through this before starting the Kickstarter.
Right. Well, then they did make a Kickstarter for this.
Oh no.
You know, Omni Romance roguelike dungeon crawler. And that's why I said I don't want to like put these people on blast because they're cool people and they make other things that I like, but
and their hearts were probably still in the right place.
Oh yeah, the hearts were definitely in the right place. And but I did back that that roguelike Kickstarter, and on whatever the lowest level was, I think, and it has been stalled out for a long time just because the people involved all have had like, you know, other projects that they had to do, because a lot of them are freelance artists or programmers, or you know, I thought that I could have time to do this, and then I got a full-time job, or I thought I would have time to do this, but then I lost my full-time job, so I have to do job hunting instead of having extra time for projects. And that was, let me see here, the project, or the last update for the project was December of 2015. The estimated delivery was 2013. So it's really sad, because I know that the main person that had this idea was like really attached to that big game idea and the characters, and really want to do it. But at this point, it's clear that, he's said in other places that like it's clear that game development isn't for him. And obviously, if the rest of the team tried, or you know, if he and the rest of the team tried to make another Kickstarter, you know, nobody would back it, because this is their, you know, instead of proving that they could handle a project, they kind of did the opposite. And so that's kind of my story of like my insight of how that kind of project happens, that has really high hopes and they have lots of art and character design, and you know, look at all of these cool things that we're going to make, and it was just out of reach. And they kind of knew from the start, before they planned this, they knew that it would be something out of reach, and they got wrapped up in all of the cool ideas they had. And
yeah, that's hilarious. In some ways, it's hilarious. Well,
there's also, as in a more general rule, that's why the thing that I'm really wary of on any Kickstarter is when I see stretch goals that will, you know,
add new mechanics.
Like Shovel Knight is a fantastic example of success, and they had stretch goals for wildly different campaigns that, you know, clearly would take, you know, years of time to complete, and they have, but they released the basic game in full, and they've been adding these extra campaigns after the fact. And in fact, I just started playing the Spectre Knight campaign recently, and if the stretch goal is something that they can add as time after the main project completes, then that's fine. But if they have stretch goals that will prevent the project from being released, that will, you know, change something fundamentally, that will, like, just delay the entire project and add a ton of work, then that tells me that they don't have a clear, you know, they don't have a clear scope and timeline, and whether or not they can deliver in the time that they gave depends on how much funding they get, rather than being a even approximate but set plan.
Star Citizen is the, like, highest funded Kickstarter game to date, at least last I checked. It's still the highest. It's an insane, like, I know they went over 100 million, like, I want to say 2 years ago, as the, like, the slacker backer sort of method. But even the initial run, Star Citizen earned crazy funds. And because of that, they decided, you know what, that original space sim game we sold, we're not doing that anymore. Like, they'll still release that eventually, but really, they're now building this entirely separate game that mm-hmm. incorporates that original game somewhere within it. Like, that is how bloated Star Citizen has become. It's just, like, the original game is just this one small part of the whole now, which I don't even know what to think about that game anymore. It'll come out eventually, I'm sure, in some form, even if it is just a, hey, this beta version, we're just going to call the final release and we're done, bye. At least it's something better than what, like, I remember there's one Kickstarter story that I still, like, I think this was in the earlier days, where the game got funded, and it was like two guys, who were like the leads on it. And the guy who was in charge of all the finance, took the money and bought a house with it.
Oh, are you talking about the Doom that came to Atlantic City?
I don't know.
It was a board game that sounds like what you're describing.
No, it wasn't a board game. I remember it was on Kotaku. It was a video game, but actually, board games, as far as Kickstarter goes, are some of the only things that I'll still even consider. Because at least with a board game, by the point they're bringing it to Kickstarter, they've already developed the game itself. They usually, at that point, just need to finalize the art and distribution and stuff like that. The actual components. So I have still Kickstarted some games. Like, one of my favorites, Burgle Bros. Mm-hmm. I got off of Kickstarter, and I've been thoroughly happy with that.
Yeah, the Doom that came to Atlantic City was
it's the after show. It doesn't matter if I type.
It was a pretty extreme example of Kickstarter failure. I don't remember the specifics, but it was like someone that had been, I think it was like someone that was contracted to run the Kickstarter, or that had been contracted to manufacture the game.
Oh, I found it.
It took the money and ran, and left the people who actually designed the game basically on the hook for all of these people that were angry at them. And an actual board game publisher ended up swooping in and basically saying, hey, we're going to buy the rights to this game, and as part of the deal, we're going to manufacture it and actually deliver to all of the backers to kind of so that we don't have this ill will attached to the game.
I looked it up. The story I was particularly thinking about was actually a Kickstarter for 3D printers.
Ah.
Which the guy used the money to just buy a house, or build the house, it says here. And then they still tried to build the 3D printers, but just didn't have the money for it. And they did a whole, like, YouTube video where they confess to what everything happened, and it's a lot of drama. When was this?
There's a very strong rumor that...
Oh, this was in 2016.
Oh, There's a strong rumor related to the Homestuck adventure game, which has also been severely behind schedule and also affected the Homestuck comic. And, like, at least according to the rumor that, according to the rumor, the reason that they can't confirm this was the company that they contracted basically as part of the agreement to get back the remaining funds, they had to not tell people that this company screwed them over. But according to said rumor, it was also why the Homestuck comic, when it was getting ready for the big finish, just stalled out for multiple years and sort of lost all momentum and fan base, and people kind of forgot about it before it eventually popped up and finished. So it's kind of a sad story, but also technically unconfirmed that that's exactly what happened.
Okay. If there's anything else you want to bring up, go ahead. But I need to start wrapping up.
Mm-hmm. No, I think we're all kickstarted out at this point.
Yeah.
We both have a lot of stories and strong feelings about that site and general process.
I've been following I get emails whenever you back something, and I'm still surprised at some of those things that you decide to buy or back. But yeah, I'm out, but that's fine. And with that, we will bring this podcast to an end. Have a good one.
You too.